So that is something to think about. If you have topics that you want to cover, and we want to go more in depth on comparative aspects, we could look and see if there's a chapter in here. I can copy that chapter. I can't copy the whole book because that's not allowed, but I can give it like a chapter or something, and then we can look at that and look at primary articles, things like that. If you have a topic that you're interested in, just email. You know, this is kind of like whatever you really have an interest in. And if not, that's, you know, we're going to be covering some cool stuff. So far, it's been, hey, let's get to know what we're doing and chit chat, because people might add or drop, and I didn't want to go over too much content right away, right? That's good. There's Julie. Well, Julie might need them too. Who knows?
Thank you so much.
Yeah. That's it. Just one. All right. That's to get you motivated. Get you chatting. So we were just saying that you could choose topics if you wanted to, go into something more in-depth. There's lots of things to do on a comparative aspect. There's so much. I mean, there's a whole journal even on comparative endocrinology. Can you imagine comparative endocrinology? Just all about different critters So there's so many things, and even if you're interested in just sensory receptors, we could talk about that on a comparative aspect. Everything, there's just a ton of material that we can cover. Some of you might be more interested in like skeletal muscle or muscle in general, comparative aspects. There's really cool topics in muscle as well, if you're interested. Maybe it fits with research. Or do we want to go into digestion or something else? Maybe we can do that. I'm not that familiar with it, but maybe that's the whole part of it. We can all learn together. Maybe you can give us some input. Or if somebody's working in a lab and you want to talk about some of your research and we want more cover, you know, that topic, we can do that as well, too. So it's very easy going. All right. But I wanted to make sure that we at least hit some of this beginning aspect of cellular metabolism, like anaerobic and aerobic, because that's the cellular foundation for everything else that we're pretty much chit-chatting about, right? So let's just go through some things a little bit to make sure we're all on the same page, because everybody has a different background on content. All right, so I just wanted to go through, and some of you that had 350 animal fish, you're going to say, oh, God, I remember all that stuff, right? I don't want to go through it again. Our biochemistry, but it's good to get us all on the same page, and maybe a little bit of variety that we haven't had before. So let's just kind of cruise through this quickly. Some review of cellular metabolism. Okay. You won't fall asleep because you're too cold to fall asleep. What happens inside the cell, right? Did we have this last time? I forget where we left off. Kind of?
Briefly.
Okay. Metabolism, Christy, the mitochondria. Remember, they're all different types of mitochondria in the sense of ones that are branched out. They found out that they could bud also inside of cells, right? They can divide. Amazing work. I think I mentioned about satellite cells that are on muscle that can divide. They're not in the muscle cell, but they're in the plasma membrane, and the satellite cells sit in there and they divide. But they found out, they stained up mitochondria, they found out when those satellite cells, particularly if muscle's damaged, the satellite cell can divide, so it's a stem cell, and then one of those can actually sit on the plasma membrane of the muscle cell, make like a little fusion pore, and it gets its mitochondria inside the muscle cell. I mean, that's just wild stuff, right? And then not only that, but the nucleus of the satellite cell goes inside the muscle cell. Just like blow you away, right? That is so cool. So there's lots of things that are interesting. It's new ideas. When that was discovered, it was like, this is unreal. You know, you just didn't really think about that happening, right? So it's really quite amazing. But the mitochondria then can help for metabolism, right? And especially they think in these damaged cells, like muscle cells, this is important then for recovery of those muscle cells. And they found out the mitochondria actually have different metabolism depending on where it is inside the cell. So not all the mitochondria are functioning the same way. That's another wild thing as well. So that's pretty cool to think about. All right, so let's think about what is this mitochondria and why do we use it, right? To make ATP, we all know powerhouse of the cell, right? And that this is where oxygen is utilized to help make ATP. We're gonna go through that a little bit. So, you know, and electron acceptors for oxidation and reduction. And let's go through some of those processes and then I think this will be kind of a refresher. So aerobic, anaerobic, aerobic with oxygen, anaerobic without oxygen. And let's just think about what's happening here. So if you break down ATP, right, ADP and inorganic phosphate, what do you liberate? Heat, right? So when you're shivering today, trying to be, you know, warm up, it's not really to try to get your muscles to move, right? But it's just to warm you up. So that shivering is basically just metabolism, and you're breaking down your ATP and you warm up. So also the same thing with brown fat. You've probably heard of, you know, newborn babies have that little fat between their shoulder blades, the brown fat. It's not really for, you know, for the baby to move around, right? It's basically to keep their metabolism, the homeostasis of their body temperature. They just burn brown fat, and we'll go a little bit about that, talk a little bit about it, but it's basically just making ATP and breaking it down, making ATP and breaking it down, and the fat being utilized, and that raises the body temperature. So it's not really for anything else aspects. They did find, this was interesting, a few years back, and there was actually a paper from U of L where these researchers did it. They found, they thought that we didn't really have brown fat in our muscles much, but they did find brown fat in adults, and they finding, what does this do for us? And is it the same kind of aspect, just breaking it down for metabolism? So there's new stuff all the time being found out, you know, about human physiology as well. So it's pretty cool. Okay, so let's go through a little bit about these processes. I think we might remember, you know, when we go through glycolysis or the TCA stuff, we make NADH. It's kind of equivalent to 3-ATP, and FADH is equivalent to 2-ATP. Let's talk a little bit about that as we go through. So what do we want to take home? You've already had this. You've known this. If you had biochemistry, you've learned it ad nauseum, and then you purged it as fast as you probably could, right? But in the cytosol, so in the cell cytoplasm, you go through glycolysis, right, TCA, and then you make pyruvate, and then you go into the TCA cycle, citric acid cycle, or Krebs cycle. Did we talk about that before? It's the same name, right? It's not three different cycles. They're all the same name. Hans Krebs worked that out. So, and this happens in the mitochondrial matrix. You make some ATP. So in the glycolysis, we'll chit-chat about it again, show some pictures. You make 4-ATP, usually if you're studying for MCAT and stuff, sometimes there's trick questions out there. You make 4-ATP, but you use 2-ATP, so the net production's 2-ATP in glycolysis, generally. And then you make these NADHs. They have twos written here for the numbers that you're making, and then these can go into the mitochondria or into the and be utilized to make ATP, but we'll talk a little bit more about that. Make acetyl-CoA. So here's your anaerobic metabolism, glycolysis being broken down to pyruvate, acetate, and even lactic acid, right? And then we'll mention a little bit more about that. And then you go to the TCA cycle, go through that two times because you make two acetyl-CoAs, and then of these NADHs and FADHs, they go into the mitochondria and you make your ATP. So some textbooks show 38, 34, 32. It's not that efficient, exactly the number of ATP, but in the ballpark, let's just say 32 to around 34. But if some people count these as three NADHs up here and three here that are made in glycolysis in the sense of making ATP, but to get these into the mitochondria, it takes energy. So this is where we lose some of the energy. So this is why numbers don't match exactly when you make your count of ATP. I don't want you to bog down in all this. I want you to get the main picture. And the main picture is glycolysis, cytoplasm, and the cytosol doesn't need oxygen. When you go through these cycles in the TCA cycle electron transport chain, you need oxygen for this last step, but we're gonna see some exceptions to it in a little bit. Okay, so where did that figure? What's going on here? That one went crazy. Okay.
anyways, there's a lot of steps in there. Don't have to memorize all these steps, but in case you're, okay. But the main idea is glucose broken down to 2-3 carbon chains. That's that acetyl-CoA that goes through the cycle 2 times, okay? Don't try to memorize all these steps. It's not, we're not in biochemistry class. But the idea is that glycolysis is not that efficient, right? And so you want to really go through the TCA and electron transport chain to get your most energy out of molecules. So, okay. So let's go through this. So the citric acid cycle, this is where it's kind of interesting because you make carbon dioxide in these processes, and we talked about CO2, right? CO2 plus water gives you what? Bicarb and hydrogen ion because of the enzyme carbonic anhydrase, which is a very fast enzyme. It works a millionfold faster, that process, with carbonic anhydrase. There's some interesting, if we wanted to cover some primary papers about carbonic anhydrase itself, because they've looked at it in different animals and organisms, and every organism they've looked at in animals has the enzyme carbonic anhydrase. So that's how important it is. Amazing, right? So you have that inside your red blood cells. When you make CO2 from metabolism as a byproduct in your, say, exercising skeletal muscle, CO2 is a gas. It can go right across the bilipid membrane. It can get into the mitochondria. Into the red blood cell, sorry, into the red blood cell, and it can be converted very fast. Or it can also be within the cell that makes the CO2. It can actually be converted to bicarb and hydrogen ion quickly as well, too. So in your cellular metabolism, how do you get rid of that CO2? Just to kind of refresh you, you convert it to bicarb. The bicarb in your red blood cell travels up to your lungs. In your lungs and your epithelial tissue, you have, and in the red blood cell itself, what are you doing in your lungs? Blowing out CO2. So there's a driving gradient to take CO2 away. You convert that bicarb back to CO2, and then you blow out the CO2. So most of the CO2 in your body is transported by bicarb through your body, and then you blow out the CO2. So you make the CO2 in your skeletal muscle when you're exercising, convert it to bicarb through carbonic anhydrase, then you go to your lungs and you blow out the CO2. Isn't that wild? It's pretty wild. And it's a very fast enzyme. So people have looked at this carbonic anhydrase enzyme in different animals, and they find isoenzymes, some that are actually work faster than other animals that have carbonic anhydrase, because there's a little differences in the sequence of the carbonic anhydrase, right? It's the same gene that makes carbonic anhydrase, but there might be some differences in the genomic sequence that gives you different amino acids. It still works the same way, but some of them are more efficient than others. So it's kind of interesting. So you call these isoenzymes because it's just the same thing, but maybe the sequence is a little bit different. Right? And that's the aspect with human disorders too, diseases. You might have the same basic enzyme that works, but then there's something different about it, right, that doesn't work the same way. Same with proteins in your body. Well, maybe we should... Just to get an idea. So if you looked at, go ahead, Max.
Yeah, so the isoenzymes, I know that there are genes that have differences within populations.
Yes.
Say, would the bicarb one be more like in certain populations you'll see this one genomic strain versus others, or is it kind of just
mutations happen? Yeah, so we could find it. It's an older literature, but it would be great to pull up maybe one of these primary papers where they've actually sequenced and looked at the protein. So proteomics is really where to go, because sometimes the same gene is there, but then the protein's different. So how does that happen? Anybody remember from cell biology? You have the same gene, but you're looking at different animals, but the protein sequence is different. But the gene, the genomic...
Splicing.
Pardon?
Splicing.
Yes, splicing or alternative modifications, right? And from your Golgi apparatus and all that. So a good example is when they started to look, and it relates to human health, is if you looked at our genome, we have, it was kind of a debate, but 14 to 15 serotonin receptors for the DNA for sequencing to make those receptors, right? So you think, oh, then we only have about 14 or 15 different types of serotonin receptors in our body. But when you look at the protein, you find out, and you isolate the protein, you find out that we have, in the human population, they've isolated now about 54, did I get that right? 34, sorry, I'm thinking of something else. About 34 different receptors for serotonin. Isn't that wild? But the gene is only like 14 or 15. So how do you get 34 different types? That's wild. Alternative splicing, right? And so post-translational modification, you're already making the protein, but it's modified from the Golgi to the time it's a protein to be put in. So what does that tell you? That tells you that medications that are agonist or antagonist might bind at different affinities to those receptors, and this is the issue. That sometimes that medication doesn't work the same in you or somebody else. It's going to work differently. It's going to bind stronger. They even found, if you think about, I don't want to know if you're on, but Prozac is an antidepressant, right? So people take Prozac. Okay, that's okay. The thing is that sometimes it works so much more efficient in other people than it does in other people. For example, they've done some really nice studies through the Asian population. They used Japanese and Koreans, for example, in a lot of these studies. And they found out that some people don't respond that well to the antidepressant, and others have to take a lot more of it for it to actually function. Well, they found out that they have different, so the antidepressant like Prozac blocks, so here's your nerve, right? Nerve, vesicle inside the nerve. The vesicle fuses, releases serotonin, let's say. Okay, what happens to serotonin in the synaptic cleft? It's taken back up by a transporter. It's transported back into the nerve terminal, and then it's in the nerve terminal, and then it's transported back into the vesicle, different type of transporter, different transporter here, then it's put back in the vesicle, and then can fuse again, so it recycles. The transporter that brings it into the nerve terminal, that's where some of the antidepressants work. They can block that transporter so you keep more serotonin in the synaptic cleft. That's the general idea. It's not completely, but that's the general idea. They found out that that transporter has different isoforms, the same genome, but different isoforms. So the antidepressant works differently, binds differently to the transporter for serotonin. So they find out that other people need a higher level. This is where you get down to individual medicine based on your profiles. But how do you do that? I mean, how are you going to look at the protein level in someone's brain to know that, right? The genome might be the same, but if you get post-translational modifications, how do you know? So they did look at studies where they found out there are gene differences in making the transporter. It still transports serotonin, but they were able to isolate that there are differences, and this is why some people needed more of the antidepressant than others. But what's the problem with that? Then you're going to go to a higher level, you get more side effects. And there's always side effects with high levels. So it's really interesting. So it gets so complicated, right? Now you think of it on a comparative aspect. Wow, like we talked about, you want to look at rodent models, you want to do Drosophila models. Well, how much post-translational modification do they have that you want to make an analogy to the humans, right? And maybe the genome's the same, but they have a different levels of post-translational modification. So then you're going to have to do proteomics. So this is where the field has gone to proteomics. Kind of just genomics is kind of passed a bit, and now we're looking at proteomics, looking at protein differences in different animals for the same, basically, gene sequence for that protein, right? Okay, so this gets really complicated, and this is kind of where I think it's just like, wow, there's so much out there to do, you know, still. And this could explain a lot of the differences, not only in human health and medications and treatments, but also variations that you see in other animal models that you might want to be testing to, you know, on drugs, right? For example, maybe they don't respond the same way because something else is different and not just the gene, right? So this is all something to think about. I know we went on a severe tangent just now, but you get the idea. Carbonic anhydrase. 1,000 times faster. You can look at different types of isoforms. Yeah, a million times faster. Cool. All right, so we're going down the road. So we get down to the citric acid cycle, went through glycolysis, we get acetyl-CoA, We get enter into the citric acid cycle. We have more CO2. Hans Krebs, which is also named, you know, TCA, citric acid, Hans Krebs, he was the one that actually worked out a lot of this process. And how did he do this? He labeled carbon, and he's with carbon 14, and he labeled to find out where CO2 was coming off, right? And that's amazing to figure out. This is how he worked that out a long time ago. And the CO2, as we just mentioned, then he could see it formed as a gas that you would breathe out. I mean, that was just wild. Like, wow, where is that coming from, right? We had CO2, and that's just amazing. What do you think about that CO2 that you're making from your cell metabolism? Do you think it goes into carbon structures to make amino acids? I mean, your proteins, you know, in your body, if it's in the cell, could it be utilized to make an amino acid or protein? Something to think about. We'll talk a little bit about that. Isn't that wild? How much CO2 do you make in your GI tract? Anybody remember from 350? So all that bacteria that's in your GI tract, we need it, right? It helps metabolize your food, but it's going to have waste products, which is CO2, gas. If we talked to my kids, they've always called them gas bombs, you know. Flatulence is the word, flatulence, right? The real scientific word of a fart, if you will. So flatulence. How much CO2 do you generally make in your GI tract? It depends on what you're eating, right? But the byproduct is you make a lot of CO2. So what happens to all the CO2? How much do you think you make just on general? They try to analyze this.
Is it like 1 to 3 liters?
Yeah, even more than that. They estimated about 10 liters of CO2 you make in your GI tract. Isn't that crazy? But you don't fart 10 liters of CO2 out. Where does it go? It's absorbed into your bloodstream. And then what? Bicarb? Blow it out. So actually, from the bacterial digestion that's in your GI tract, you're blowing out the waste products. Isn't that wild? That's just wild, right? I think it's really wild. It's amazing. Okay, so some things to think about in that aspect. Okay, so here's this TCA cycle, or citric acid cycle, that goes through. What's kind of interesting is, here's the CO2 is made. You don't have to memorize all this stuff. But the idea that this will take place, and generally in your textbooks say, well, this won't take place if you don't have oxygen, because the NADHs won't, in the FDH, won't be able to go into the mitochondria to be then utilized with oxygen, and this whole process will back up. And this is kind of like the idea, because if you have a lot of FADH or NADH, they have negative feedback processes on some of the enzymes. And if too much ATP is around, there's negative feedback as well. So this is the idea that some of those enzymes then won't be functioning throughout these steps because of too much of the products. And then it says, oh, we don't need to be making this because you're not utilizing the NADH, you're not using the FADH. That's the general idea. You do make ATP in here, but through GTP. So you do make one ATP, but you go through the cycle two times, right? So you make the two ATPs. That's the general idea. Okay, so just hold on to the general idea. But some of these key products like alpha-ketoglutarate, just kind of keep that one in mind for a little bit here, and then we'll look through this. So then you get to the electron transport chain, and we want to, you know, get to the next step. And then oxygen is this final electron acceptor, and then this then allows this process to work. And then here's your metabolic water. Okay, so C6H12O6 plus six oxygens to break down glucose. Your byproduct is six CO2s, right? Your ATPs, metabolic water, six waters as well. So then that's your byproducts from, say, a complete breakdown of glucose, and of course heat from all that as well. Okay, so you get the general idea. Right. So they go through the electron transport chain in the mitochondria, in the inner mitochondrial membrane. So this is where you've already incorporated your NADH from glycolysis, it got inside the mitochondria, it took some energy to get in there, that's why the count is a little bit low on the ATP production, because it took ATP to get it in. And then you go through all this electron transport chain. You don't have to memorize it, but there's diseases with different forms of these electron complexes, which is really interesting as well. But then you pump this hydrogen ion into your space between the outer and inner mitochondrial membrane, and then when that hydrogen ion comes through this protein here, ATP synthase. This thing's spinning around. I don't know if you've ever seen the videos of this thing. It's just like spinning around when hydrogen ion comes through and it makes ATP. So here's your ATP. Okay, this is pretty cool. The general structure of this is pretty cool too. Two different layers of bilipid membranes, a whole complex of their hydrogen ions being put in between these layers, and then you can make your ATP. Now that ATP does what? This is inside your mitochondria. But that ATP has to get out of the mitochondria and be utilized for pumps on your cell membrane, right? Pump sodium out, or pump sodium in and potassium out, those kind of things. Did I just say that backwards? Yes. Sodium out and potassium in, the sodium-potassium pump, are other pumps like calcium pumping calcium out, are helping in protein machinery to make proteins, right? So that ATP has to get out of the mitochondria into the cell. So that is another different process that's not covered that much in many classes, but that's a whole other aspect that needs to be considered too, just stay in the mitochondria. Okay, so the general idea is this, right? So you're making about 30 ATPs for every glucose. Some textbooks say 32, some say 34. If you try to add up all the NADHs, people come up with 38, but it's not real because you need to take energy to get your NADHs into the mitochondria. Okay, this is the general idea. So this is what's referred to as, you know, aerobic, because you're using oxygen. All right, so let's think about this. All this heat that's being made, right? Different animals, different processes. Why do we need ATP, you know, for energy production? So why is ATP an energy molecule? And just like we kind of try to bring up when we have workshops, for example, with teachers and others, we talk about ATP, you know, why is it an energy molecule? And we always just kind of memorize it's an energy source, right? The mitochondria is your powerhouse of the cell. We teach everybody. But if I had a bottle of ATP here, would it be explosive? It's energy, right? It's going to, no. So why is ATP an energy molecule? Why do we call it an energy molecule? Lauren?
Because it has the ability to, like, phosphorylate all different things.
Exactly. It's the thought. Is that what you were going to say over there? You had your hand up. Somebody had?
No.
Phosphorylation steps, right? It can phosphorylate a protein. It can phosphorylate an enzyme. Remember, all enzymes are proteins. It can phosphorylate that enzyme and cause a conformational change when it adds a phosphate. And that conformational change can turn on the enzyme. It can turn off the enzyme. It can turn on a pump, make a pump work. It can, you know, do lots of things. So ATP is the energy molecule because of phosphorylation, not that it's there and it's going to explode on us. And then the breaking off of one phosphate produces NADP, right? Adenosine diphosphate, and then inorganic phosphate. And you can even take ADP, something we don't cover that much, and break that down, right? So now you have AMP, adenosine monophosphate, with only one phosphate group on, and you can still get another phosphate out of it. So the ADP can be broken down to AMP plus phosphate. So you can really get a lot of energy out of the ATP is the idea. Okay. All right, so anaerobic conditions. But if you don't have oxygen, what happens when you exercise? You're going to build up lactic acid in your muscle. What happens to that lactic acid? Some people say that's why you have Charlie horses or muscle cramps, but it's not true because people have studied that, and it's kind of a misnomer that we think about with lactic acid buildup. But of course, that's not great for your body because it's acidic, and it can also bind up other factors like calcium, so that's not so great. What is Charlie horses from? Generally, they think now?
Sodium.
Not potassium, another kind of conception that they thought. Eat more bananas and things like that. Kiwis have more potassium than bananas, but they found out with ultra runners, these guys or gals, people, that run 100 miles, you know, for days, and they're just like crazy. They do this and they get cramps, but they take blood samples out of these people. They volunteer to do these kind of studies, ultra runners, and they find out when they did get a cramp, their potassium levels were okay. It's the sodium levels that dropped. So this is why it's a lot of sodium that people would eat if they're exercising. And if you go in a race, for example, what do they have at those race stops? If you ever want to run a ultra marathon or something.
Pickle juice.
Exactly, dill pickle juice. It's fantastic. They call it the miracle drink, right? And so you'll go to the rest stops and you'll wonder, what's that little yellow stuff? It looks like urine, right? No, it's dill pickle juice. And so people drink it. Initially, when they first started doing this, you saw pickle jars. They would take out the pickles and just kind of like pour in the pickle juice. Now you can just buy pickle juice. And basically, it's vinegar and a lot of salt, sodium in there. And that supposedly helps keep your muscle cramps down. Isn't that weird? So we kind of had this misconception it was potassium. They found out it really isn't sodium. That's wild. Okay, but what happens to that lactic acid that builds up in there? It's going higher in your blood. Yes?
I'll just say it takes like hours for it to clear. So kind of counterproductive, but you just consider it as like stored potential energy.
Mm-hmm. And so where does it go after that? I mean, we might pee some of it out, maybe, but there's a way to get energy out of it too, or back to your body. Any ideas?
Doesn't it turn into like glucose 6-phosphate or something?
Yeah, gluconeogenesis. So it goes to your liver. It goes to your liver and it goes back to glucose. It takes ATP to do it, but you can make glucose again from it. So it's called gluconeogenesis. So this is a way to recycle that. And we're going to talk about other animals that can do this really well, keep the lactic acid level higher. And it takes energy, but you don't have to waste it that way. It's not wasted out to the environment, right? So how efficient is that? What if somebody has liver problems? Cirrhosis of the liver, they're going to have problems with this lactic acid staying even higher, and no longer problems that they're going to have with it. I know some of you are interested in allied health, but think of it as even on a comparative aspect with animals, right? If their liver is gone, then lactic acid is going to stay even higher for a longer period of time and cause more problems. Acidosis in your body is really bad, right? If you just looked at your cell membrane potential, we can talk about that. If you lower your pH, which is more acidic, right? You lower your pH, your cells will depolarize. The more acidic it is, the cells depolarize. Your neurons depolarize, your heart cells depolarize, your skeletal muscles depolarize with an acidic environment. So depolarization, arrhythmias is what they're worried about, and your nervous system not functioning, right? So you think about, you need to maintain this pH, but as you exercise, what's happening to the cells? Or you're thinking all the time, right? You're using up glucose in your neurons, you're getting byproduct CO2. In your neurons, and the pH around those are going to drop unless you have carbonic anhydrase converted to bicarb. Try to get that out, right? But even in your brain, people wonder what is fatigue. People have been studying this for years. When you're studying all the time and you're really concentrating and maybe studying for exams, and here you don't have to stress out, but you get tired. What's tired from? Why is your brain like, I can't think anymore, I'm just so tired? But you're not really, you got good sleep the night before, but you're still really tired. What does that do to? What's at the cellular level?
Well, could it be possible that it has to do with the neurons that are growing as you're learning, and then as you fall asleep, there's neuroplasticity that would bring them back to normal?
Yeah, I mean, that could be for the long term, but then you think about right now, like right happening, if you're studying really hard and you're trying to do all those math and you're just like, I'm just tired. Is it the byproducts? Is it the CO2 that's raised? Is it the pH that dropped? Is it the lack of glucose in there? What is it, right? It's kind of weird. Think if you're running too. Let's say you're exercising. You're running that race. You're running. And then I was like, I'm just too tired. But there's a finish line. And you start walking, right? What's fatigue? How do you measure fatigue? But let's say someone's behind you, that drill sergeant, the kind of person, and they might even have a little, like a little taser, like they do for cattle, like a cattle prog, if you raise cattle, right? You have these little cattle progs, they shock. What if somebody came behind you and started shocking you, like when you're fatigued and you're kind of like, oh, I can run again, And so is it the inability to be able to run? Is it the inability of, is it lack of glucose and glycogen in your stores? But you can keep going if you've really got push and someone's like, shocking you, right? That hurts. And so you get going. So this is the problem. Fatigue has a mental component to it. So this is why it's really difficult when people start to study this fatigue of like synaptic transmission, fatigue of your muscles. So they get rid of that experimentally. You look at the neuromuscular junction itself, take that nerve and the muscle out, put it in the dish, stimulate the nerve, record the muscles being able to twitch, right? And now you stimulate, and the muscle starts to stop twitching. Well, is it due to something about the nerve, or is it due to the muscle itself? So then you say, oh, we're going to get rid of the nerve. We're going to put electrodes directly on the muscle fiber, and we're going to stimulate the muscle fiber repetitively. So that keeps twitching, and then finally it will slow down in time. But they found out that the nerve can fatigue as well. And some of it has to do with sodium goes in, potassium goes out, but if you haven't recovered from the, it depends on the rate that you do this, you can go into, remember the shape of the action potential? It goes up, depolarizes, right? What happens? Sodium goes into the cell, the sodium channels opened, depolarizes, but what happens to the sodium channels as they open? They inactivate, right? It takes some time at rest for them to recover from that inactivation. So if you stimulate too fast, they go into that refractory period that you probably know. We'll cover more in that, so don't worry about getting lost if that's new to you right now. And then, so that could be part of it. So they wanted to get rid of that and just stimulate the muscle directly. And then you can find out if it has more glycogen content. Yes, it could last longer, and then you understand the muscle itself. So experimentally, when you look at fatigue or depression, well, where is it at a cellular level, and what does it do to, right? So this is kind of where the history has come about, and understanding some of these processes of metabolism has confused the older literature for quite a bit. Okay, so this lactate, back to pyruvate, that's the gluconeogenesis that can happen. It's kind of like glycolysis in reverse, but not exactly, okay? Do you cover some of that in biochem, gluconeogenesis? Okay. And they probably would horrify if I just said glycolysis in reverse, but it's generally that way. Okay, all right. So this is what we just went through, right? No oxygen, anaerobic conditions, glycolysis, you don't make too much ATP, a net of two, but really you made four, but you used two, so it's a net of two. And then if you have oxygen around, you can have that electron acceptor, and then oxygen being utilized, citric acid cycle, TCA cycle, electron transport chain, and then you get your ATP and CO2 and metabolic water. Okay, so we look at those mitochondria. There's lots of unique things, aspects with this mitochondria. Some people take Q10. Anybody ever hear of Q10? You go to a health food store, you take Q10. People take that Q10. Why do they take Q10? They think it helps with energy metabolism, because Q10, you can look up this link if you want to, but Q10 supposedly gets into your mitochondria. It helps you with metabolism and might allow you to have more energy. All these supplements are, you know, suspect, but there's some ideas behind that that might be feasible. Who knows? So you can get supplements that take Q10, but you wonder about all the other steps involved too, so maybe you need more than Q10. Who knows? Here's your ATP and your three phosphates, but we mentioned, you know, energy, you get AMP. You can actually take off this one as well as this one. These phosphates then can be used for phosphorylation and steps. Okay, so the idea is you get so many kilocals per mole of ATP. Okay, but is glucose the only aspect and ATP the only way, you know, breaking down glucose to ATP, the only way to get energy? No. So all these other molecules can give you a phosphate group too. And so some people take phosphocreatine as another supplement. And that has been shown to actually have some beneficial effects, to give you storage, that you have creatinine storage in your muscle cells, and it does provide you with more energy source. So that's kind of interesting. Julie?
I know that, like, there's other places, like there's GTP, there's like all that stuff for like other channels, but I know ATP's, Is it the most abundant because ATP doesn't have as many like carbonyl groups, and so it's more like it's more energy, or is there a reason why
GTP is not used? You mean?
No, it is used.
Yeah.
But like, why is ATP the most abundant form of what we usually talk about, and not GTP or like?
Oh, because you don't make that much of the GTP,
okay.
You know, compared to your ATP, all the ATP that you make, right?
Is there a reason? Is it because of just the?
It's probably that just what's going on in that TCA cycle. You just make one, you make two GTPs for the breakdown of the glucose, right? But all the rest can get converted. The FADHs and NADHs can all get converted to ATP, and you make more of that than you will
Because NADH cannot be converted into GTP.
It might. I don't know.
Okay.
Okay. So that could be. Could be. I just don't know. Something we could look up together. But they're pretty cool. So they've looked at these other, like the 1,3-diphosphate glycerate phosphophenylpyruvate in other animals. Migratory birds, for example, you know, the Arctic tern is supposedly the most migratory animal around. It goes from all the way up in the Arctic, all the way to South America, far down South America, and then all the way back again. I don't know how on earth a bird does it. But anyways, they've monitored the muscle when these birds land and then take samples of them, and then they find out that they migrate a long ways to this other spot where they regather nutrients again. Where is it? Nebraska is a really good spot where a lot of migratory birds come in. They eat the grass, the grains, and then they migrate again. So if we get rid of these things, we really affect migratory pathways, right? But they've sampled the muscle fibers, and they see creatinine goes up, they see it drops by the time they just start landing in the next field, and then they build up again, and it goes down again. So it's kind of interesting, along with glycogen stores, and people take phosphocreatinine as well as an energy. So I just want you to realize it's not all ATP, it's other things too, maybe even more than what's shown on here, okay? There's the general idea again. We got enough. But there's something unique about this picture here, or this figure. What's over there in the far left? Lipids. What's on the far right? Proteins. So if you run out of your glycogen, and you don't have any more of that to break down, guess what you start to break down? Hopefully, some of that little fat right there, right? And then you can break that fat. But then, what happens after that? You start wasting your muscle, and the muscle's your mass. So you start to atrophy your muscle, right? So in severe starvation, you're gonna start to break down muscle, get amino acids, because why? Those amino acids can be utilized for energy. Your cells are very greedy. They will waste the rest of your body to keep the ATP levels there. So this is kind of the interesting part. I did talk a little bit about feedback, so this is why those cycles will back up. So just to kind of get you the idea, here's the TCA cycle. Look at it. Pyruvate going to acetyl-CoA, inhibited by ATP. CoA, as well as NADH, inhibited by ATP. These are your, you know, rate-limiting steps in the whole process too, but they can be stimulated by ADP, so if you don't have as much ATP and you got ADP around, this will stimulate this pathway. This one's gonna inhibit as well if you have too much of the NADH. So if you're not utilizing, the idea is that anaerobic metabolism and aerobic metabolism. Aerobic will back up if you're not using that oxygen, because you're going to build up your NADHs and you can get feedback inhibition, right? So this is how the whole process can back up. So I don't want you to memorize all the steps, but just to kind of think about, oh, there's a lot of negative feedback and positive feedback that's going on in these processes too, to regulate it all. Okay. We were looking at the mitochondria. Isn't that so cool, that mitochondria? And hopefully you've heard of this endosymbiotic theory, right, by Lynn, that worked all this out. She is phenomenal. So we're going to go to her little website that she has here. So the idea is the mitochondria, we know, has mitochondrial DNA, which is different than your cellular, the DNA that's inside your nucleus, right? The mitochondrial DNA is different. Wow, that's wild, right? So some of the proteins that you make in your nucleus DNA, the nucleus of your cell, right? The part of that proteins that are made there can go into the mitochondria, and then the mitochondrial DNA makes another part of a protein. Those two come together and make a functional protein like an enzyme. Wild. It's combining with the mitochondrial protein and the protein from the cell itself, right? So that's pretty neat. What else is inside of that mitochondrial DNA? What else is different about mitochondrial DNA from your cell nucleus DNA? Any ideas?
Circular.
Circular. And what else is circular DNA inside of other kinds of critters, if you will, organisms? Bacteria. So this is the whole idea, that a bacteria has incorporated into the cells of eukaryotic cells, and that bacteria is the mitochondria, right? And that, because it's so similar in so many ways. And she came up with that idea a long time ago. Doesn't show very well on this slide. And people boo-hooed her. Said, no, this can't be. It's too crazy. The more and more that we've been studying it, the more and more likely this is the case, because the DNA in bacteria is like your mitochondrial DNA. And that's really wild. So by studying bacterial DNA and defects in bacteria and how processes work in bacteria, we understand how our mitochondria work. Isn't that wild? That's really wild. So she came up with this, and she really talked a lot about it. She was actually a really big component of this right here, which is really cool. The Gaia hypothesis, I guess you pronounce it. And think about this. This is really cool that living organisms interact with inorganic surroundings of the earth, like your minerals. And people thought, oh, this is kind of like foo-foo, naturalistic kind of stuff, right? Because then there's like, are things connected? What do you think? Do we need the environment? Do we need to worry about what's out in your soil and all that kind of stuff? What do you think? Do we really care about that, you know, that much? Is it really connected up together? Maybe not.
There's a lot of examples of like environment interactions.
Yeah.
It doesn't seem like that far of a stretch.
Not that far of a stretch. Do we need metals in our body? What do we need metals for?
Hemoglobin.
Hemoglobin, iron. So iron in your diet comes from where? It's not from the air, you're not breathing it in. You're eating it from the food. Where does it come from in the food? The soil. How about zinc? Do we need zinc? Yes. Do we need copper? Yes. Any other elements?
The nitrogen cycle is pretty important.
And the nitrogen cycle is very important.
The infections from soil.
Uh-huh.
The rumen bacteria in cattle require cobalt.
And cobalt. And that's required. And zinc. Copper is required. So essential metals, copper, zinc, molybdenum, selenium. Selenium proteins are very important for ribosomal RNA, copper, iron. We need these metals. Wow, that's your environment. They need to go into plants. You're not eating the metal directly, right? They go into the plants. The plants you eat, those metals then are in your GI tract, and they get transported. Some of those are not so great because they can accumulate in your brain, even though we need zinc. But they find out if you have too much zinc, it actually accumulates in your substantia nigra. And they've looked at some Parkinson's patients and found out they had high levels of zinc in their substantia nigra, and that might have caused the Parkinson's. There's still studies being done where they feed rats high levels of zinc to find out if they can induce Parkinson's in them. So people say, go to the supplement store. And guess what you're going to find? A bottle of zinc. A bottle of chromium. People take chromium because when they get sick, they think, oh, more chromium will help me with my immune system, and they take chromium. You know, there's different types of chromium. There's chromium trichromium. There's chromium hexachromate. Some of that is very toxic, but the chromium-3 is okay to take because that's what we need, but the other kind of chromium, chromium-6, is very damaging to your DNA. So, maybe this wasn't such a bad idea, right? Because we are connected to our environment. Where is your food grown? What kind of soil is it grown in?
Rich mineral soil.
Mineral soil, you hope, right? But there's strawberry farms in California, there's strawberry farms in southern Texas, there's strawberry farms in Florida. Where's your citrus growing, you know, in Florida? Do they fertilize it? Do they add minerals to the ground? Or do they not do that? Is it grown? There was a study at one time where they actually found out with, I think it was cherry trees, where cherry trees were grown somewhere in Missouri. Then it wasn't working really well for them. So then they got rid of the cherry trees. But then when they were looking at the vegetables, and you wonder how many of your things that you eat are actually investigated, are actually tested by FDA, Food and Drug Administration. How many strawberry plants all across the country or world, because we import a lot from other countries as well, food, How much of that is actually tested at all those levels? Does it have too much chromium? Does it have any cadmium in it? Does it have other metals that are bad for us, right? What do you think? We're going to quit eating after when you start to think about it all.
I know that for at least like iron, you have like no free iron in your body, right. And it's so important that like bacteria can use that as an advantage. But to me, that begs that a lot of those minerals are regulated pretty tightly in the body. So if you have cherry trees or things like that that are growing.
Oh, cherry trees will grow, but the problem is the cherry seed inside of it, when it's broken down, guess what comes out of the cherry seeds? When they're told not to eat cherry seeds, what is it that's inside cherry seeds?
Cyanide.
Cyanide. Guess what they found in the vegetables of this place that used to be a cherry tree farm? Cyanide. It went into the lettuce. It went into the carrots. And people were eating it, and they got cyanide poisoning. They didn't know where it was coming from. It was the ground.
Apple seeds too.
And it was because of the orchard that was there before. But nobody studied the lettuce until the people were coming up with these, you know, cyanide poisoning, and they're like, my God, where is that coming from? And they found out this is wild. Isn't that crazy? So you wonder how much of your food, all that food coming in, is it all tested at every level to see that it's another? So iron, zinc, accumulating in your brain. So maybe, yeah, your body can get rid of a lot of things. Selenium, supposedly, you can eat pretty much of it and you can excrete it out. But guess what are the side effects if you have too much selenium? I was beginning to wonder if I had it, because one of the things are baldness. And so and actually, if you have high doses of selenium, you'll lose your hair. Isn't that wild? And the same with arsenic. High levels of arsenic, but that's not an essential metal, so that's toxic. But high levels of selenium, you need selenium in your diet. This is important to have selenium. There's a fruit from Trinidad that people eat. It's got very small fruit. I forgot the name of it. But people eat that, and a lot of people were losing their hair, and they didn't realize. So they were saying, don't eat too much of that. It has very high selenium in it, and it can cause your hair loss. Anybody ever like woodworking? You know, you take your patio furniture. What happens to your patio furniture over time? It gets kind of gross, gets fungus on it and stuff like that. It's treated with chemicals. But you might want to do what? I want to finish it off better, right? So there's an interesting study. It was one of these, you know, case studies that you hear about on TV, where the person was, he was having problems with the skin. Actually, it was a dermatologist who picked it up. They were having problems with their skin, and they were having hair loss. And so they said, well, we need to find out. It was really just falling out a lot faster than just aging. Hopefully mine's just aging. And then my parents, it's a genetic thing. And so they tested his blood and found out you have arsenic in your blood. How did you get arsenic? Where are you getting arsenic from? This is crazy. And then it was like suspicion. His wife was trying to kill him. And so he, you know, got all worried about his wife, you know, poisoning his food and everything else. Got into the FBI investigation following what was going on and checking his diets. And they found out it was actually a dermatologist that found out. What do you do as a hobby? Just chatting with him. Good, you know, case study. Kind of find out more about the history of the person. He liked finishing furniture. Furniture, outdoor furniture, is treated with what? All these chemicals that keep mold from growing. One of the chemicals is arsenic. So they found out in his sanding of all that, he was breathing all that sand dust, all that particle dust, and he was getting arsenic, so his wife wasn't trying to kill him. And then she got upset with him for telling him that she thought he was trying to kill him. So it was really kind of interesting, the whole process. So don't be breathing that stuff, you know, when you're sanding like that. It is treated with a antifungal, bacteria, and arsenic.
I saw a paper that was like, it was like a big like meta-analysis or something, but that like women are more likely to get, I think it's lung cancer or something, because they are cleaning more with like all the chemicals and everything. And
probably,
like, people are like, no, actually, like, switch to natural stuff, especially if you clean a lot. And
that's
because
good.
Women are doing more cleaning than men.
Yeah. I can't imagine that. Yeah, no. My wife makes me vacuum and all kinds of things. So that's kind of interesting to think about. But I want you to think about your food. You need these metals, but at what levels? And how much of our food is actually tested? We talked about the water, right? And, you know, chlorine, chloramines. So your water used to just have chlorine in it, and that was really good. You could bubble it and the chlorine would go out, but it kills the bacteria. Now, because of the chlorine is kind of toxic and for the workers too, they use chloramine. They use an organic compound. And if you raise fish or something like that and you're putting that in your fish tank, you can't just bubble the water and get the chlorine out anymore. You have to use something to get it out. So we use carbon filters. It takes out that organic chloramine compound. So if you want to get the chlorine out. But what happens to your GI tract? We talked about that, right? Your GI tract is different because of the chlorine that you drink in your water and the chloramines. It kills out, because it's good for your water. It kills out your bacteria in the water, right? To make it safer for you so you don't get sick. Right, so this is kind of interesting, but it changes your gut microbiome compared to other people that don't have that. So it's an interesting thing. That's probably one of the, another reason that if you go to other countries and you drink their water and you get sick, it's because we have a different microflora from that differences. So this is pretty interesting. When I was reading this, I was really like, wow, this is really cool. And then you find out who she was married to, which was kind of even more cool. And you know, you went off on a tangent here again. And let's see, where did it say? She was married to, what is it? History nerd. She was married. It's pretty cool. Then Margot's married. Anyways, I think her kid, good grief, for the conference, criticism, natural. There's a whole bunch about her. That's really quite interesting. But, I don't want to spend time trying to find here. But, here it is. Richard Dawkins, didn't believe in this. Sagan. I think it's, Sagan was her kid. If anybody's ever read about Sagan, Carl Sagan, right? Okay, so it's kind of interesting. Anyways, all right, so that's this stuff. Okay, where are we? We are here. All right, so that's kind of neat. All right, so we're back to whole idea about mitochondria being from bacteria, right? That's where we left off before the tangents. Okay, so then how do we get other energy from molecules? Well, fatty acid cycle. Don't try to memorize any of that stuff. But the fatty acid cycle, you break down fat, goes to acetyl-CoA, goes inside there. So other animals store fat, like seals and other things, but serves dual purpose, right? It's insulation from the cold, but also can be utilized if they're needing to break down that blubber and that fat. They can actually then, you'll see a starving seal actually loses the blubber, but then they actually can't control their temperature as well either. So then there's lots of problems with that. But the blubber can be broken down to fat and be used in the fatty acid cycle. So that's kind of interesting too. Here's your gluconeogenesis back to your liver, and you can make back glucose and reutilize it again, but it does take ATP to do that. So it does utilize aspects. Glycogen, really interesting molecule. You get your glucose out of glycogen, right? Break these off. You have different enzymes in your body to help break down glycogen. In times of plenty, you take that extra glucose and you make glycogen. It takes ATP to make it, but now you have an energy source, right? And then you can break it down when you need it. So it's kind of neat too. Glycogen's in your skeletal muscle stored, glycogen in your liver, for example. But if you have liver diseases, then this is a problem as well. Okay, so that's pretty cool. So let's think about something else. So you saw that you can break down proteins to amino acids. They can enter into your TCA cycle, like glutamate from amino acids being broken down can be converted to alpha-ketoglutarate. And now that can be utilized inside of your TCA cycle. That's pretty cool. So proteins being broken down to be utilized to make ATP. How about amino acids to glucose? Can that happen? Can you go all the way back up to glucose? Isn't that wild? That's pretty wild. So glucose to amino acids. Well, we kind of, and then make amino acids from glucose. So let's look at that. So here you go. So here's your amino acids that can be converted into the TCA cycle, right? And then you get ATP out of it. That's pretty cool. And then we have here And these are all those links that we were talking about. The raw material for amino acid synthesis is obtained from glucose. The amino acids are synthesized at the cost of ATP, reducing the power of NADH. Many bacterial plants can synthesize all 20 amino acids. Wow. But we need amino acids. We need essential amino acids, but you know, to eat in our diet. But a bacteria can survive. They make them all. What's wrong with us humans? You know, we need it in our diet to keep going. We can't make it all. So that's kind of interesting too, but
we don't have a lot of the enzymes.
We don't have the enzymes to do it, right? So bacteria. I wish I was a bacterium. You know, so who knows? So that's kind of interesting to think about, that bacteria can make all those amino acids. So that's pretty cool. Now, what was this thing? Here's your glue. Oh, no, that's something else. We'll get rid of that one. And then we want to talk about that other part where you can actually, so you can, all these amino acids that are broken down in proteins being utilized, right, as we mentioned, that's really cool. So it's kind of hard to figure out metabolism and your CO2 production and your ATP production, because at the same time, you're not just breaking down glucose, you're breaking down proteins, they're recycling, they're entering at different levels. And so it's kind of hard to do the whole metabolism, understand exactly, you know, your ATPs when you're trying to do counts and things like this. This is what finally they realized kind of confuses the literature when you're working out these processes. Okay, so we got rid of that. Okay, so here is your glucose being broken down to amino acids as well. It goes the other way also. So you're breaking down glucose to make amino acids. What do you use these amino acids for? Making proteins, right? And this is all happening inside the cell. So now you have amino acids going to glucose, you have glucose going to amino acids, depending on your need. Isn't that wild? Going both ways, right? That's pretty cool to think about. Which is even more weird is this one here. The glutamate that you have is amino acids either from protein or alpha-ketoglutarate, which can be converted to glutamate. And these are the mitochondria. In your nervous system, you have your mitochondria. But guess what? One of the transmitters is in your nervous system, glutamate. So now you can make a neurotransmitter to be utilized for your nervous system, right, to release glutamate. So now we're going from glutamate, alpha-ketoglutarate. Maybe we use it. Maybe we don't. Maybe we got extra, you know, maybe we're depleted in our glutamate, so we can go back to glutamate and put that into a synaptic vesicle and use it for neurotransmission. And glutamate itself can be actually converted to GABA. So now you have GABA and you have your inhibitory neurotransmitter. So you have the most common excitatory neurotransmitter and the most common inhibitory transmitter, glutamate, GABA. Wow. And it can all relate to your breaking down your proteins and utilizing your amino acids. I just find that to be amazing. It just shows you it's all together. It's like those biochemistry charts that you see and all the little arrows, and you're just like, blah.
Pretty much of all the amino acids that, I guess, for both from amino acids and sucrose, what is the most common one that you would use for both amino acids? They're not all synthesized equally, right?
That's right. Yeah, because some of your proteins have more of some amino acids than others, right? But if you could break it down and get some energy out of it, it's pretty cool.
More proteolytic, some are more glucose.
Yeah, that's a good answer. So that's is pretty cool. I just find it just amazingly cool, the whole thing. All right, so that's pretty cool. And then we just showed you the textbook that showed you aspects of these. So you can label these. People do this. They label these and then find out where they're going to be converted to, what is finally a product, you know, like carbon labeling or some other must. Now, can you make glucose? Can glucose be made into DNA? Wow, that's a really big step, isn't it? That's a big step. Glucose to DNA. So if you click on that article, we get to, did I get to this one? Yes. So here's your glucose. Here's your steps. Look what's going on over here. Purines. Now you got your DNA. Isn't that wild? That is just wild. Wild. I never knew that before, you know, studying, probably learned it one time and purged it in biochemistry class, because you just memorize and forget it all right, as fast as you can. But that's pretty cool. Wow, making up the DNA, you know, that's another wild thing out there. Okay, we can get rid of that one, we can get rid of that one. That's pretty cool. So now, we got to all these good steps. Where are we at now? All right, where did we get to? We went through all that already. All right. So we went through this bisodic nerves, went through that, went through that, went through that. We have amino acids, glucose to amino acids to glucose. We went from glucose to DNA. That's just wild. Okay. And then we talked about CO2 to the body to making proteins. Can you use that carbon that you have in CO2 to make proteins, maybe? You know, the carbon cycle of the world, right? Recycling everything, you know. It's all here, planet Earth. Doesn't come from somewhere else, right? When you die, your nutrients go into the soil. I like the idea of